striking looks as his colleague, Dr. Benzinger. Roof's smiling, professorial posture made it hard to imagine he had spent so much time supervising medical experiments inside the Dachau concentration camp, including Rascher's murderous high-altitude studies in experimental cell block 5. Like Benzinger, Roof was an avowed and dedicated Nazi. He joined the party in 1938. The facility Dr. Roof was in charge of for the Third Reich was located just 10 miles across town from the institute that Dr. Strughold oversaw. As the directors of the two most important Luftwaffe medical facilities in Berlin, Roof and Strughold collaborated closely on a number of projects during the war. Roof and Strughold co-authored several papers together and co-edited Aviation Medicine, Luftfahrtmedizin. One of the articles they co-wrote so fascinated the U.S. Army Air Corps that in 1942, intelligence officers had it translated and circulated among flight surgeons at Wright Field. The two men also co-authored a book called The Compendium on Aviation Medicine, which served as a kind of handbook for Luftwaffe flight surgeons and included articles on explosive decompression and oxygen deficiency. At Heidelberg, Dr. Roof was in charge of this work again, only now it was paid for by the U.S. Army. Working directly under Dr. Roof at the Aero Medical Center was Dr. Konrad Schaffer, listed in declassified documents as also researching the effects of G-forces on the body. This was not Schaffer's primary area of expertise. His wartime research work, which had been supported by both the Nazi Party's Reich Research Council and the Luftwaffe, was the pathology of thirst. Schaffer was a tall man, slightly overweight, with a receding hairline and thick-lensed glasses that made him appear slightly cross-eyed. Unlike most of his colleagues, Schaffer avoided joining the Nazi Party, which he later said cost him jobs. In 1941, he was drafted and sent to a Luftwaffe air base at Frankfurt on the Oder. When his talents as a chemist came to light, he'd worked as chief physiological chemist for the firm Schering AG. Schaffer was transferred to Berlin and given an assignment in Luftwaffe C emergencies. This included research on various methods to render seawater potable, Schaffer later explained under oath. Sea emergencies were an area of great concern. As the man in charge of aviation medical research for the Luftwaffe, Dr. Strughold had solutions to sea emergencies high on his priority list. During the air war, every pilot knew that drinking ocean water destroyed the kidneys and brought death faster than suffering indomitable thirst. But German pilots shot down over the sea and awaiting rescue were known to break down and drink seawater anyway. The Luftwaffe announced a contest. Any doctor or chemist who could develop a method to separate the salt from seawater would be greatly rewarded. Konrad Schaffer, one of Strughold's protégés in Berlin, aimed to solve that conundrum. Schaffer worked in cooperation with IG Farben to create Wulfen, a mixture from barium and silver zeolith, he later explained, which he synthesized into a tablet named Wulfetit, which was developed to separate the salt in a residue. The results produced drinkable water, which was a remarkable achievement. Schaffer had succeeded where so many other doctors and chemists had failed. Dr. Oskar Schroeder, head of the Luftwaffe Medical Corps, was thrilled. Konrad Schaffer had developed a process which actually precipitated the salts from the seawater, Schroeder later testified. But another group of Luftwaffe doctors were already backing a different process called the Burka method, which was bad news for the Schaffer process. It was thought by the chief of the Luftwaffe medical service to be too bulky and expensive, Schroeder explained. A second contest was proposed. This one to see which desalination method was superior. The effectiveness of both the Schaffer process and the Burka method would be tested on the Untermenschen at Dachau. A Luftwaffe physician named Hermann Becker-Freising was assigned to assist Dr. Schaffer and to co-author with him a paper documenting the results of the contest. The senior doctor advising Becker-Freising and Schaffer in their work was Dr. Siegfried Ruff. The resultant paper, called Thirst and Thirst Quenching in Emergency Situations at Sea, described saltwater medical experiments conducted on prisoners inside experimental cell block 5. Dr. Hermann Becker-Freising had been a member of the Nazi Party since 1938. His specialty was oxygen poisoning in the human body. An odd-looking man, Becker-Freising's unusually large ears gave the appearance of handles on either side of his head. During the war, Becker-Freising served as chief of the Department for Aviation Medicine and Medical Services in the Luftwaffe, another branch under an umbrella of medical facilities and laboratories overseen by Dr. Strughold. Becker-Freising was held in great esteem by his colleagues, many of whom, under interrogation, described him as heroic for the masochistic extremes he was willing to go in auto-experimentation. Becker-Freising conducted over 100 experiments on himself, many of which rendered him unconscious. At least one took him to the brink of death. The story repeated most often about Becker-Freising was of a self-experiment he did in a chamber, also with a rabbit. Determined to learn how much oxygen could poison a man, Becker-Freising went into a low-pressure chamber with a rabbit with the goal of staying inside for 3 days. A few hours shy of his goal, Becker-Freising began to show symptoms of paralysis. The rabbit died, Becker-Freising recuperated, Strughold later explained under oath. That was all during the war. Now, Ruff, Benzinger, Schaffer, Schroeder, and Becker-Freising, with the approval of Strughold and Armstrong, continued their work on secret aviation medical projects initially conceived for Hitler's war machine. The Army Air Force's Aero Medical Center in Heidelberg was a squat, brick, two-story facility facing the Neckar River. Only a few months prior, it had been the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Medical Research, a bastion of Nazi science where chemists and physicists worked on projects for the Reich's war machine. At its front entrance, the Reich's flag came down and the U.S. flag went up. Photographs of Hitler were pulled from the walls and replaced by framed photographs of Army Air Force's generals in military pose. Most of the furniture stayed the same. In the dining room, German waiters in white server's coats provided table service at mealtimes. A single 5x8 requisition receipt dated September 14, 1945, made the transition official. This property is needed by U.S. forces, and the requisition is in proportion to the resources of the country. The mission statement of the project, classified top secret, was succinct. The exploitation of certain uncompleted German aviation medical research projects. Dr. Strughold was put in charge of hiring doctors, all of whom are considered authorities in a particular field of medicine. Across the American zone of Germany, entire laboratories were dismantled and reassembled here at the secret facility in Heidelberg. More than 20 tons of medical research equipment was salvaged from the Tempelhof Airport in Berlin, including a huge human centrifuge and a low-pressure chamber the length of 2 ordinary Pullman cars. There was equipment here that American physicians had never seen before, esoteric items including a Nagel anomaloscope, a Zeiss-made interferometer, an Engelking Hartung adaptometer, a Schmidt-Hansch photometer, and a precision-built Siemens electron microscope with which to study night vision, blood circulation, G-forces, and the bends. Even the low-pressure chamber from Georg Welz's research facility at Freising near the Munich dairy farm was brought to Heidelberg. This was the laboratory where Dr. Leo Alexander had experienced his revelation that Nazi doctors had been freezing people to death. It was a precarious time for doctors who had previously worked for the Reich. With the Nuremberg trial underway, the international press had its attention focused on war crimes. German doctors were looked at with suspicion. Articles about Nazi doctors, including the November 1945 piece in the Washington Post about the science of freezing humans, put a spotlight on German medicine. Many doctors fled the country to South America through escape routes called rat lines. Others tried to blend in by offering their services in displaced persons camps. Some killed themselves. Maximilian de Krienis, chief of the psychiatric department at the University Charité in Berlin, swallowed a cyanide capsule in the last days of the war. Ernst Robert Gravitz, physician for the SS and president of the German Red Cross, killed himself and his family, including his young children, by detonating a small bomb inside his house outside Berlin. The Reich health leader, Leonardo Conti, hanged himself in his cell at Nuremberg. Ernst Holzlerner, the senior doctor at the University of Berlin, who conducted the freezing experiments at Dachau with Sigmund Rascher, committed suicide in June 1945 after being interrogated by British investigators. The list of suicides was long, but the number of German doctors believed to have been involved in war crimes was even longer. The U.S. War Crimes Office for the Chief Counsel wrote up a list of doctors involved in medical research that resulted in mercy killings, a euphemism used by the Reich for its medical murder programs. The list was classified with a strict caveat that access to it remain restricted for 80 years from the date of creation. This meant that by the time the world would know who was on this list, it would be the year 2025, and everyone named would be dead. A copy of the list was given to the commander of the Army Air Force's Aeromedical Center, Robert J. Benford. Five doctors working at the center, starting in the fall of 1945, were on the list. Theodore Benzinger, Siegfried Ruf, Konrad Schaffer, Hermann Becker-Freising, and Oskar Schroeder. Instead of firing these physicians suspected of heinous war crimes, the center kept the doctors in its employ, and the list was classified. The list remained secret from the public until 2012, when the Department of Defense, DOD, agreed to declassify it for this book. Chapter 12. Total War of Apocalyptic Proportions. By the end of January 1946, 160 Nazi scientists had been secreted into America. The single largest group was comprised of the 115 rocket specialists at Fort Bliss, Texas, led by Wernher von Braun. The men resided in a two-story barracks on the Fort Bliss reservation and worked in a laboratory that was formerly the William Beaumont General Hospital. They ate in a mess hall shared with Native American Indians, which only enhanced von Braun's perception that he was living life inside an adventure novel. "It is such a romantic Carl May affair," von Braun wrote in a letter to his parents in Germany. Carl May was a German novelist famous for his cowboy and Indian westerns. Soon, von Braun would begin writing a novel of his own, in the science fiction genre, about space travel to Mars. Von Braun loved the desert landscape, the cactus, the vast gypsum dune fields, and the long drives in open army jeeps. Rocket work was not perfect, but it progressed. Frankly, we were disappointed with what we found in this country during our first year or so, von Braun later recalled. At Peenemünde, we'd been coddled. Here, they were counting pennies, he said of the U.S. Army. V-2 launchings would take place about 80 miles away, on the White Sands Proving Ground, and getting there meant a long and beautiful ride. An army bus took scientists around the Franklin Mountains, through El Paso, and along the Rio Grande to Las Cruces. Next came the rugged journey over the San Andreas Pass and into the Tularosa Basin, where the Army's proving grounds began. 12 to 15 Germans were sent at a time to White Sands, where they lived in barracks alongside men from the General Electric Company and a technical army unit. The actual rocket firings took place inside a single 40-foot-deep pit, with the Germans watching the launches from a massive but rudimentary concrete blockhouse nearby. When the first V-2 was launched in April 1946, it climbed to 3 miles. Although one of the fins fell off, von Braun felt inspired to draft a memo to Robert Oppenheimer, director of Los Alamos, proposing the idea of merging his missile with the atomic bomb. The memo turned into a proposal, use of atomic warheads in projected missiles, submitted to the Army. In it, von Braun discussed building a rocket that could carry a 2,000-plus pound nuclear payload a distance of 1,000 miles. Two personal changes in von Braun were afoot. The first was that he joined an evangelical Christian church and became born again, something he rarely discussed in public. The second was that he decided to marry his first cousin, Maria von Quistorp, the daughter of his mother's brother, Alexander von Quistorp. Von Braun was nearly twice her age. She had just turned 18 in the summer of 1946, and she lived in Germany. From Texas, von Braun began making plans to bring his future bride to the United States. Descriptions of life out west in America varied from scientist to scientist. The conditions of employment were considered to be fair and generous by all, said Dieter Hützel, the engineer who'd stashed the V-2 documents in the Dorton mine. Arthur Rudolph liked the fact that the swimming pool and the bowling alley were made available to the Germans exclusively one afternoon a week. He told his biographer, who did not want to be publicly identified and wrote using a pseudonym, Thomas Franklin, that he missed his family and his Bible. Von Braun's brother, Magnus, was being investigated by the FBI for selling a platinum bar he had illegally smuggled into the United States. Interrogators with the Department of Justice found Magnus von Braun to be snobby and conceited, and said that he seemed to pose a worse threat to security than a half a dozen discredited SS generals. For Army ordnance, there were many problems to overcome. Funding was scarce. Shrinking military budgets offered very little room for missile development immediately after the end of a world war. Also at Fort Bliss, the Army discovered that not all the so-called rocket scientists had the talents they allegedly possessed. Carl Otto Fleischer, Major Staver's original lead for the Dorton mine, and the man who led him on the wild goose chase around the Harz and to the Inn of the Three Lime Trees, claimed to have been the Wehrmacht's business manager, when in reality he had been in charge of food services. In Texas, Fleischer was assigned the job of club manager until he was finally repatriated to Germany. Von Braun had also sold the Army on hiring Walter Weissmann, a Nazi public relations officer who had done some work in the Peenemünde valve shop. Von Braun called him an eminent scientist. In reality, Weissmann learned engineering in America working for the Army. 1,500 miles across the country in the winter of 1946, There were now 30 German scientists at Wright Field. Colonel Pott considered this sum to be offensively low. At least once a month, he wrote to Army Air Force's headquarters in Washington, requesting more German scientists and inquiring why the importation of these rare mines was happening at a snail's pace. In fact, there was very little for the Germans to do at Wright Field, and many of them were restless. The Air Documents Research Center, formerly in London, had also moved to the Air Material Command headquarters at Wright Field. There, 500 employees sorted, cataloged, indexed, and put on microfiche some 1,500 tons of German documents captured by Alsace, SIOS, and T-forces after the war. So abundant was the material that more than 100,000 technical words had been added to the Air Material Command's English Language Dictionary. The plethora of information provided some work opportunities for a predominantly idle group of German specialists, who in turn resented this kind of work. The Germans perceived themselves as inventors and visionaries, not librarians or bureaucrats. One of the Germans, a Nazi businessman named Albert Patin, had been keeping track of the group's complaints, which now made their way to Colonel Pott's desk. It was not just the lack of challenging work, said the Germans. It was the whole package deal. The hilltop was a dump. Payments were slow. The mail to Germany was even slower. Dayton had no civilized culture. The laboratory facilities at Wright Field were nothing compared to the grand laboratories of the Third Reich. In general, the Germans told Pott, they were beginning to distrust their American hosts, based on promises broken by USA officers. Colonel Pott's next move was a controversial one. He appealed to Albert Patin for help. At 58, Patin was one of the more senior Germans at the hilltop. He was a wartime armaments contractor whose numerous factories produced equipment for the Luftwaffe under the Speer Ministry. When Patin's facilities were first captured by the U.S. Army, one of the American technical investigators, Captain H. Freiberger, was so amazed by Patin's industrial vision that he called the soundness of his principles a revelation. For Colonel Pott, Albert Patin's wartime innovations represented the best and the brightest of Reich science. Pott coveted the scientific inventions that Patin's factories mass-produced, which included navigation aids, in-flight steering mechanisms, and automatic control devices. This kind of technology would give the Army Air Forces a 10-year jump on anything the Russians had, Pott believed. Hiring Patin for a U.S. Army Air Forces contract meant ignoring his past. His armaments factories used slave labor, which was a war crime. In an autobiographical report for Pott, Albert Patin admitted that many of the people in his 6,000-person workforce were slave laborers supplied by Heinrich Himmler's SS. Patin stated that he was not ashamed of this. He explained to Colonel Pott that he had been one of the better bosses in the Third Reich. He didn't encircle his factories in electric fencing like other industrialists did. Patin acknowledged that his wartime access to Hitler's inner circle benefited his businesses, but he did not see how this made him a war profiteer. He was just following orders. Patin took summer holidays with the Göring family and winter trips with Albert Speer's munitions procurement chief, Dieter Stahl. But so did a lot of people. He was no better and no worse. During this slow period at Wright Field, Colonel Pott had Albert Patin survey the other Germans. He told Patin to be alert to grudges so that Patin could formalize his list of complaints. Pott would in turn forward this summary to his superiors at Air Material Command. Patin's job, Pott counseled, was to emphasize how the Germans had become depressed, even suicidal, without their families and without the promise of long-term work. Colonel Putt sent Patin's summary of complaints to Air Force headquarters in Washington, to the attention of Brigadier General John A. Samford. In his own cover letter, Putt requested that immediate action be taken to improve the morale of the Germans and save the existing situation. The name Albert Patin had already caught General Samford's eye. All mail sent to the scientists at Wright Field was screened by Army intelligence first. Albert Patin regularly received letters from his staff back in Germany, many of whom also sought work in the United States. A letter had recently been sent to Patin in which lucrative offers from French and Russian intelligence agents were discussed. Brigadier General Samford's office was made aware of this unwelcome development. Coupled with the summary of German scientists' dissatisfaction, General Samford took action. He sent the complaint list as well as Patin's intercepted mail to the War Department. Immediate action in this situation is imperative if we are to divert the services of valuable scientists from France and Russia to the United States, General Samford warned his colleagues. The timing created a perfect storm. The Joint Intelligence Committee was in the process of implementing a major policy change. It had just warned the Joint Chiefs that the existing idea of using restraint when dealing with the Soviets needed to be reconsidered. Unless the migration of important German scientists and technicians into the Soviet zone is stopped, read a JIC memo to the Joint Chiefs, we believe that the Soviet Union, within a relatively short time, may equal United States developments in the fields of atomic research and guided missiles, and may be ahead of U.S. developments in other fields of great military importance, including infrared, television, and jet propulsion. The JIC also stated, incorrectly, that German nuclear physicists were helping the Russians develop a nuclear bomb, and that their assistance had already cut substantially, probably by several years, the time needed for the USSR to achieve practical results. In reality, the Soviets had gotten to where they were in atomic bomb development not because of any German rare mines, but by stealing information from American scientists at Los Alamos. Not until 1949 would the CIA learn that the Russian mole was a British scientist named Carl Fuchs, who worked on the Manhattan Project. In response to the perception that the Soviets were getting all the important German scientists, the Joint Intelligence Committee proposed to the JOA that three changes be implemented in the Nazi scientist program effective immediately. The first was to do everything possible in Germany to prevent more scientists from working for the Russians. The second was that the U.S. Army was to make sure that German scientists and their families were given whatever it was they were asking for, including American visas. Third, a list was drawn up, proposing that as many as 1,000 additional Germans be brought to America for weapons-related research. For Samuel Klaus, the second proposed policy change was untenable. The Nazi scientist program was originally defined as temporary, with scientists working under military custody. That was how the War Department was able to circumvent immigration law for all the scientists already here. Now, the JOA was demanding that immigration visas be issued to scientists and their families. Even if the policy change were approved, Klaus argued, the visa process was a slow-going one. The State Department was legally required to approve each scientist's visa application individually. This was not an overnight task, but a lengthy, investigative process. The person requesting a visa was required to list on his or her application contacts who would in turn be interviewed by a representative from state. the Office of the Military Government in Germany needed to compile a security report on each individual scientist. Nazi Party records would have to be pulled from the Berlin Document Center. If a scientist had won an honorary award from the National Socialist German Workers' Party, NSDAP, the Nazi Party, or was a member of the SS or the SA, that needed to be explained. This was the law, Klaus said. With the new information about the Soviets, Robert Patterson, now Secretary of War, shifted from being wary of the Nazi scientist program to becoming its champion. Only a year earlier, Patterson had called the German scientists enemies capable of sabotaging our war effort and had warned the Joint Chiefs of Staff that bringing them to this country raises delicate questions. Now, he stated in a memorandum that the War Department should do everything possible to clear away obstacles that may be raised in the State Department. This, in turn, caused Secretary of State James F. Burns, Samuel Klaus's boss, to soften his opposition to Operation Overcast. Due to the emerging Soviet threat, Secretary of State Burns and Secretary of War Patterson agreed informally that leaving German scientists unsupervised inside Germany, where they could be bought by the Russians, was too dangerous. If the State Department required individual investigations, so be it, Burns said. German scientists and their families should be allowed to enter the country under temporary military custody with an interim State Department blessing, Patterson wrote. The logic was simple. If we don't get them, the Russians will. The State War Navy Coordinating Committee, now acting as an advisory board to JOA, confirmed agreement with the positions of the Secretaries of War and State, but added another consideration to the argument. German scientists, left to their own devices, presented serious military implications to the future of United States security, according to Swink. In other words, Samuel Klaus's argument could now be used against him in the military's attempt to speed up the visa application process. Yes, the German scientists were inherently untrustworthy, so much so that they could not be trusted if they were left unsupervised, let alone left available to competing powers. On March 4, 1946, Swink paper number 275-5 went into effect. German scientists could now be admitted to the United States in a classified program that was in the national interest. This shifted the focus from whether or not someone was a Nazi to whether they were someone the Russians would be interested in. The commander-in-chief of U.S. Forces of Occupation in Germany and commander of U.S. Forces European Theater, USFET, General Joseph T. McNarney, was told to draft a list of 1,000 top scientists in Germany who were to be brought to the United States at once so the Russians couldn't get them. A military intelligence officer named Colonel R. D. Wentworth was assigned to provide General McNarney with material support on behalf of Army Intelligence G2. The scientists' families were to be given food and clothing and were to be housed in a secret military facility northeast of Munich called Landshut until their visa applications were approved. It was a radical revision of the initial terms of the German scientist program, and it was exactly what the JOA had envisioned all along. The following month, the members of JOA were called together to spend an entire day hammering out new program protocols. Expert consultants like Alsace scientific director Samuel Goudsmit were invited to attend. Expedite the German scientist program, said the Joint Chiefs of Staff. There were now 175 German scientists in America under military custody, none of whom had visas. The consensus, save Klaus, was that the application process needed to be sped up. The thorniest issue had to do with getting the State Department to approve certain individuals who had clearly been Nazi ideologues, including members of the SS and SA. Also at issue were those men who received high awards for their important contributions to the Nazi Party. These were people that by regulation were entirely ineligible for citizenship. The meeting resulted in a clever workaround. Army intelligence officers reviewing the OMGUS security reports of certain scientists could discreetly attach a paperclip to the files of the more troublesome cases. Those files would not be presented to the State Department right away. Instead, those men would remain under military custody in America, most likely for a longer period of time than some of their fellows. As a result, the Nazi scientist program got a new code name. Operation Overcast had apparently been compromised after the families of the German scientists started calling their U.S. military housing Camp Overcast. So from now on, the Nazi scientist program would be called Project Paperclip. Not everyone understood the discreet paperclip attached to the file protocol. The first major setback came just a few months later, on July 17, 1946. General Joseph McNarney wrote to Joa stating that he had worked with Colonel Wentworth to identify 869 German scientists who were ready to sign paperclip contracts. But there was an obstacle. There is a large number of former Nazis and mandatory unemployables among those shown on the list, General McNarney wrote. These men cannot now or later be employed in the United States zone of Germany except in the labor category. McNarney was following USFET rules that said all members of the SS and the SA had to go through mandatory denazification trials. Citing America's national interest, the JOA would now change the language of the core principle guiding Paperclip's original charter. No known or alleged war criminals and no active Nazis would become no persons who might try and plan for the resurgence of German military potential. Assistant Secretary of War Howard Peterson felt this new language would allow the JOA to bypass the visa people, as stated in a memo dated July 24, 1946. But this was meant to be temporary. Eventually, State Department officials like Samuel Klaus would take umbrage at this language. What Joa really needed was an endorsement from President Truman. By the summer of 1946, the relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union was shattering. The legendary Long Telegram, written by George F. Keenan, America's diplomat in Moscow, had been received at the State Department, reviewed by the president and his advisors, and sent to every U.S. embassy around the world. After analyzing the Soviets' neurotic view of world affairs, Keenan warned his bosses at the State Department that, in the long run, there can be no permanent, peaceful coexistence with the Soviet Union. The two nations were destined to become steadfast enemies, Keenan said. Influenced by Keenan's insights, President Truman asked White House counsel Clark Clifford to prepare a study of the current state of affairs and the future prospects regarding Soviet-American relations from a military standpoint. To do so, Clifford culled reports and briefings from the Secretaries of War, State, and Navy, as well as the Attorney General, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, various directors of military and civil intelligence, and George Keenan. The result was an alarming top-secret analysis. The report's conclusion was made clear in the introduction. Soviet leaders believe that a conflict is inevitable between the USSR and the capitalist states, and their duty is to prepare the Soviet Union for this conflict. Clifford warned that Soviet leaders were on a path designed to lead to eventual world domination. The Russians were developing atomic weapons, guided missiles, a strategic air force, and biological and chemical weapons programs. The idea of peaceful coexistence of communist and capitalist nations is impossible, Clifford wrote. The only way to counter this threat was to use the language of military power. Not military force, but military threat. On August 30, 1946, the Undersecretary of the State Department, Dean Acheson, asked President Truman to make a decision on paperclip. If the president did not act quickly, Acheson wrote, many of the German scientists may be lost to us. After 4 days of deliberation, Truman gave his official approval of the program and agreed that Project Paperclip should be expanded to include 1,000 German scientists and technicians and allow for their eventual immigration to the United States. With presidential approval official, the Attorney General was able to expedite the proposed changes to the program. A new JOA contract was drawn up, allowing scientists who had been in the United States for 6 months to sign on for another year, and with the government maintaining the right to renew the contract for another 5 years. Operation Paperclip was transitioning from a temporary program to a long-term one. Former enemies of the state would now be eligible for coveted U.S. citizenship. In response to the Clifford Report, the Joint Intelligence Committee conducted its own classified assessment of the Soviet threat, JCS 1696. The Soviet Union, wrote the JIC, sought world domination and would begin by bringing other nations into Soviet control to isolate the capitalist world. JIC saw a future war with the Soviet Union as being of apocalyptic proportion. In a war with the Soviet Union, we must envision complete and total hostilities, unrestricted in any way on the Soviet part by adherence to any international convention or humanitarian principles, noted JCS 1696. Preparations envisaged on our part and our plans must be on this basis. In other words, for the United States to prepare for total war with the Soviets, America had to maintain military supremacy in all areas of war fighting, including chemical warfare, biological warfare, atomic warfare, and any other kind of warfare the other side dreamed up. Copies of the classified report were sent out to 37 or 38 people, says CIA historian Larry A. Valero, including the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It was not known if President Truman received a copy of JCS 1696, as he was not on the distribution list. One of the scientists on the JOA list of 1,000 was Dr. Kurt Bloma. The Allies were unsure what to do with Hitler's biological weapons maker. Clearly, no discreet paperclip attached to Bloma's file would be able to whitewash the reality of his inner circle role as Deputy Surgeon General of the Third Reich. But if the United States were to go to war with the Soviet Union, it would mean total war, and according to JCS 1696, would likely include biological warfare. America needed to envisage such a scenario and to plan for it with both sword and shield. Dr. Bloma had spent months at the dustbin interrogation facility, Castle Kranzberg, but had recently been transferred to the U.S. Army Military Intelligence Service Center at Darmstadt, located 18 miles south of Frankfurt. In the summer of 1946, Dr. Bloma was employed there by the U.S. Army in the capacity of a doctor. Dr. Kurt Bloma's experience was in great demand, but his future was yet undecided. In his Posen laboratory, Bloma had made considerable progress with live plague pathogens, including bubonic and pneumonic plague. How far that research progressed remained vague, likely because it would put an unwarranted spotlight on human experiments many believed had taken place there. Bloma repeatedly told investigators that he had intended to conduct human trials, but never actually did. Bloma's American counterpart in wartime plague weapon research was a left-leaning bacteriologist named Dr. Theodore Rosebery. During the war, the biological weapons work Rosebery conducted was so highly classified that it was considered as secret as atomic research. He had worked at a research facility outside Washington, D.C., called Camp Dietrich. It was like Posen, only bigger. Dietrich had 2,273 personnel working on top-secret biological warfare programs. Like Bloma, Rosebery worked on bubonic plague. Rosebery's colleagues worked on 199 other germ bomb projects, including anthrax spore production, plant and animal diseases, and insect research in an effort to determine which bugs were the most effective carriers of certain diseases. Almost no one in America had any idea that the U.S. Army had been developing biological weapons until January 3, 1946, when the War Department released a slim, sanitized government monograph called the Merck Report. That is when the American public learned for the first time that the government's top-secret program had been cloaked in the deepest wartime secrecy, matched only by the Manhattan Project for developing the atomic bomb. The rationale behind developing these kinds of weapons, the public was told, was the same it had been with America's wartime chemical weapons program. If the Nazis had used biological agents to kill Allied soldiers, the U.S. military would have been prepared to retaliate in kind. Yes, the war was over, Americans were now told. But unfortunately, there was a new and emerging threat out there, the Merck Report warned. An invisible and insidious evil capable of killing millions on a vast, unknowable scale. America's bioweapons program needed to continue, the Merck Report made clear. America may have won the war with the mighty atomic bomb, but biological weapons were the poor man's nuclear weapon. Biological weapons could be made by just about any country without vast expenditures of money or the construction of huge production facilities. A bioweapon could be hidden under the guise of legitimate medical or bacteriological research, the report said. The Merck Report was written by George W. Merck, a 48-year-old chemist and the owner of Merck & Company, a pharmaceutical manufacturer in New Jersey. Merck had served Presidents Roosevelt and Truman as civilian head of the U.S. biological warfare effort during the war. Merck and Company made and sold vaccines, notably the first commercial U.S. smallpox vaccine in 1898. And in 1942, it manufactured penicillin G, among the first general antibiotics. During World War II, U.S. soldiers received smallpox vaccines. The man diagnosing the bioweapons threat, George Merck, was also the man whose company might sell the government the solution to combat the threat. In 1946, this was not looked upon with the same kind of scrutiny as it might have been decades later, because America's military-industrial complex had yet to be broadly revealed. The Merck Report did not specify what kind of germ warfare had been researched and developed by the United States, only that it took place at a top-secret facility in Maryland. Camp Dietrich was a 154-acre land parcel surrounded by cow fields about an hour's drive north of Washington and under the jurisdiction of the former Chemical Warfare Service, then the Chemical Corps. After the release of the Merck report, and coupled with the ominous total war prospects as outlined in the Clifford report and the JCS 1696, Congress would grant vast sums of money to the Chemical Corps for biological weapons research, and Dietrich would expand exponentially. Dr. Kurt Blomma had information that was coveted by the bacteriologists at Camp Dietrich, and plans were being drawn up to interview him. And then, in the summer of 1946, a totally unexpected event occurred inside the Palace of Justice in Nuremberg that would render hiring Dr. Kurt Blomma for Operation Paperclip an impossibility, at least for now. In the 10th month of the trial, the Soviets presented a surprise witness, putting an unforeseen and unwelcome focus on Dr. Kurt Blomma. The witness was Major General Dr. Walter Schreiber, the shield to Blomma's sword. On August 12, 1946, prosecutors for the Soviet Union stunned the tribunal by announcing that a missing Nazi general and the former Surgeon General of the Third Reich, Major General Walter P. Schreiber, was going to testify against his colleagues at Nuremberg. Schreiber was brought forth as a witness to show that after the Nazis' crushing defeat at Stalingrad, the Third Reich was planning to retaliate by conducting a major biological warfare offensive against Soviet troops. This was the first time information about biological warfare was being presented at the trial. The Allies were not informed that Schreiber was going to be a witness. U.S. prosecutors asked to interview him in advance of his testimony, but the Soviets denied the request. The medical war crimes investigator, Dr. Leopold Alexander, appealed to speak with Schreiber himself to no avail. During the war, Schreiber held the position of wartime chief of medical services, Supreme Command Wehrmacht. He was the Third Reich's highest-ranking major general who was also a physician, and he held the title commanding officer of the scientific section of the Military Medical Academy in Berlin. Most important, he was the physician in charge of vaccines. Schreiber had been in Soviet custody for 16 months, since April 30, 1945, when he was captured by the Red Army in Berlin. According to Schreiber, he had opened a large military hospital in a subway tunnel around the corner from the Führer bunker and had been tending to several hundred wounded soldiers when the Soviets captured him. After being taken by train to the Soviet Union, he was moved around various interrogation facilities, he said, until he ended up in Lubanka prison, the notorious penitentiary located inside KGB headquarters in Moscow. Nuremberg was Schreiber's first public appearance since war's end. No one, including his family members, had any idea where he had been. That the former Surgeon General of the Third Reich was now going to help Russian prosecutors send his former Nazi colleagues to the gallows for their crimes was as ironic as it was outrageous. Dr. Schreiber was on the U.S. Army's Central Registry of War Criminals and Security Suspects list. Along with many of those colleagues, and since war's end, Major General Walter Schreiber had been sought by the Allied forces for possible war crimes. If the Americans had located him and had a chance to interrogate him, he might well have been in the dock at Nuremberg facing the hangman's noose alongside his colleagues. Instead, here he was testifying against them. It was Monday morning, August 26, 1946, when Dr. Schreiber took the stand, day 211 of the trial. Colonel Y. V. Pokrovsky, deputy chief prosecutor of the Soviet Union, presented Schreiber to the court as a witness. German defense lawyer Dr. Hans Laternzner, counsel for the General Staff and Army High Command, Oberkommando des Heeres, or OKH, objected on the grounds that the evidence was submitted too late. The tribunal is not inclined to admit any evidence so late as this, or to reopen questions which have been gone into fully before the tribunal, said the tribunal's president, Lord Justice Sir Geoffrey Lawrence. But on the other hand, in view of the importance of the statement of Major General Schreiber and its particular relevance, not only to the case of certain of the individual defendants, but also to the case of the High Command, the tribunal will allow Major General Schreiber to be heard as a witness. In other words, Schreiber was a high-ranking Nazi general, and the judges wanted to hear what he had to say. With that, Schreiber was brought to the witness stand. He stood 5'6" and weighed 156 pounds. A long-sleeved shirt covered the saber scars on his right forearm. At 53 years old, Schreiber had been an active military doctor since 1921. He was an expert in bacteriology and epidemiology and had traveled the globe studying infectious diseases, from a plague outbreak in West Africa to a malaria epidemic in Tunisia. He claimed to understand medical aspects of desert warfare and winter warfare better than anyone else in the Third Reich. He was also an expert in biological and chemical weapons, in typhus and malaria epidemics, and in the causes and conditions of jaundice and gangrene. When war came, Schreiber, an affable and ambitious son of a postal worker, was catapulted to the top of the Wehrmacht's medical chain of command. This was in part due to the Reich's zealously germ-phobic corps. Schreiber's vast knowledge of and experience with hygiene-related epidemics made his expertise highly valuable to the Nazi Party. He was put in charge of the research to fight infectious disease, and also in remedial means to defend against outbreaks. In this way, he became privy to Reich medical policy from the top down. In 1942, Hermann Göring also put General Schreiber in charge of protection against gas and bacteriological warfare, which is how he came to be in charge of the Reich's program to produce vaccines. I swear by God, the Almighty and Omniscient, that I will speak the pure truth and will withhold and add nothing, Schreiber promised when taking the oath. Major General G.A. Alexandrov, the Russian assistant prosecutor, asked Schreiber what event had compelled him to testify at Nuremberg. In the Second World War, things occurred on the German side which were against the unchangeable laws of medical ethics, Schreiber said from the stand. In the interests of the German people, of medical science in Germany, and the training of the younger generation of physicians in the future, I consider it necessary that these things should be thoroughly cleared up. The matters in question are the preparations for bacteriological warfare, and they give rise to epidemics and experiments on human beings. Schreiber was saying that the Reich had been preparing for offensive biological warfare and had used the Untermenschen, the subhumans, as guinea pigs. General Alexandrov asked General Schreiber why he had waited so long to come forth, if he had been coerced into making statements, or if he had taken the initiative himself. I myself took the initiative, Schreiber declared. When I heard the report of Dr. Kramer and Professor Holzlerner here in Nuremberg, I was deeply shocked at the obviously perverted conceptions of some of the German doctors, he said. Holzlerner and Schreiber had been close friends and colleagues. After Schreiber learned about Holzlerner's murderous freezing experiments at the Nuremberg Conference of 1942, medical problems of sea distress and winter distress, he invited Holzlerner to come give the same lecture at the Military Medical Academy in Berlin. But how had Dr. Schreiber heard these revelatory reports if he was in prison in the Soviet Union? Alexandrov asked. This had to have been a question on many people's minds. In the prison camp, German newspapers were available.